91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Voice of the Cape, 0829 913 913. No, that's not the police. That's our WhatsApp line, 0829 913 913. In our book review today, in my hand, the Stephen McGowan story as told to Tudor Caradoc Davies, 6 years with Al-Qaeda. The incredible story of the South African who became Al-Qaeda's longest-held prisoner. That was for 6 years. It's brought to you, published by Maverick 451. Online, we've got Steve McGowan and Tudor Caradoc Davies, who told Stephen's story. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Stephen McGowan, I'm going to kick off with you first of all. It's just a kind of a wild card question. Something that really struck me quite profoundly in your story was when you started to talk about the desert sand. Now, your prison was the whole Sahara. That was a big prison. And you made a point that you had to live with the sand, but the sand actually wasn't dirty. A lot of people would say, ach, sand is dirty. Your feelings on that?
Yeah, I suppose that is why the poor guys in Central America have such a problem with their sandstorms, because it pretty much, the wind blows pretty much from sunrise to sunset in the Sahara, about 365 days of the year. And what I found was the sand was incredibly clean. It appeared all the dust and all the rubbish had blown across over the ocean. But it was amazing because we would use the sand for everything. You know, we'd use it to clean, we'd use it to shower. So you take a handful of sand and clean your pots and pans. It was fantastic sand. As far as sand goes, it was very clean.
Yeah, and I mean, it really is like out of the box, but it really struck me quite profoundly. Tudor, you're the guy that had to tell the story. What was it like having to reflect not only the soul of Stephen McGowan, but other family members as well? What was your journey like?
It was one of the harder jobs I've ever had, one of the tougher tasks. Not only because, you know, the material is difficult. Some of the places that Steve had to go to tell his story to me, that was incredibly challenging, and he had to be vulnerable and honest and really open up to me. But at the same time, his wife Kat, his father Magoo, you know, everybody was on their own journey while Steve was taken prisoner. So it was fascinating to see all those little threads combine into one kind of congruent tale.
Yes, of course. I mean, Tudor, I'm sure you'd agree with me that while Stephen McGowan was in prison, all of us in the media were following it very closely. It certainly did come across as a family story, because if it hadn't have been for the activism of the family, I doubt whether much would have actually happened.
Absolutely. One of the things that Magoo, Stephen's father, pointed out is that there really isn't a blueprint for how to get your loved one back when something like this happens. You know, each family has to figure out their own way. You use as much influence as you can. You pull in all favors from friends. And then it's still a game of diplomacy and power. And you're not even sure what's happening at the higher levels of statehood, you know, what the relations are between South Africa and the UK and Mali and France. So there's so many things at play, and they really just worked so hard to get Stephen back, and a whole bunch of people contributed in the end.
And of course, Stephen, while all of this was going on, you were in this bubble. I think that's the only way that I can actually describe it, with Al-Qaeda in the middle of the desert. But I think where your story is so interesting is that it's a human story, because I think for the first time as a reader, as an observer, we are shown some personalities within an organization that is just known as Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, full stop.
For sure. I mean, what I realized in the difficult times was that we are all, in fact, human. You know, we all have different beliefs, and we all have different things that we're prepared to fight for. And obviously, Al-Qaeda have got their war that they're busy fighting. But at the end of the day, if they were to put their weapons down, what I noticed was, you know, we're all human. We all get hungry. We all get thirsty. We all want to make the best of our lives. We all want to be educated and try and better ourselves. And, you know, there certainly were some very strange and peculiar conversations that I had with them, which did put us worlds apart. But at the, you know, as far as Maslow goes, at the base level, we certainly were all very similar.
One of the bizarre things that comes out of the book, and this expresses, I would say, the extremist side of Al-Qaeda's outlook, is that when you guys were not Muslim, you were basically second-class citizens. Yet when you did become Muslim, you went up in the ladder, and all of a sudden they saw you as a human being. I struggle always to get my head around that particular worldview, to be honest with you.
Yeah, no, gee whiz, things, it was chalk and cheese, to be quite honest. You know, those first early months were absolutely terrifying, where I was never quite sure if I'd make it through a day. There were times I've literally felt I could go crazy, just from the stress of everything. And our conversion to Islam, which we did, was a very big gamble, and we were never quite sure what the outcome would be from it. But once we had converted, Al-Qaeda took a whole new view on us. We were obviously still very much prisoners, you know. If we asked too many questions, we were told that we were still very much prisoners, and we were not going home until negotiation was done. But however, there obviously was a moral responsibility towards Muslim brothers, and we were then handled better. We were spoken to better. And it certainly gave me a mental reprieve from the stress that I was feeling prior.
Of course, you had a little problem, didn't you? A little problem that became a big one. You were a South African citizen, but to make your travels easy, you were using a British passport. Oh, boy, there was a problem.
Oh, boy, I tell you, if I've ever made an error, you know, I obviously spent many years in the UK trying to acquire the UK passport, but really it was just exceptionally unfortunate that, in fact, I was caught with it on me, because that British passport haunted me literally until the final week of my captivity, when Al-Qaeda was still asking me questions, you know, so where are you actually from? Which made me irate, because that sort of explained to me why I'd been sitting in the desert for so long, because potentially they were negotiating with the wrong country. But it certainly raised the stakes, having that British passport.
No, absolutely. Tudor, to get back to you in writing this book, when one does projects like this, it's like a movie, isn't it? A lot gets left on the cutting room floor, as they say in the classics. How much did you have to leave out?
So much. I mean, you know, you mentioned sand first up, and how Steve kind of, what the sand was used for, and his affection for sand. Because I can tell you right now that the guy can talk about sand for hours on end,
right.
How much he loves it, all the different kinds. So there was just so much, you know, there were 8 snake stories and a whole bunch of other things that went on. I mean, basically, you know, there's just so much that they could put into a series or a movie. I was given a target of, I think, 80,000-90,000 words, and in the end it was closer to 130,000 when I was done, and a lot of that had to be polished by a fantastic editor called Jackie Lange.
Editors are the unsung heroes, aren't they, of our writing?
They are. Without an editor, you know, writers would be nowhere.
Absolutely. Stephen, to get back to your particular story, as I say, it's so difficult to encompass everything that a person would actually like to discuss. How were you able to deal with things psychologically? The book does show that you appear to be quite a positive-minded person, but how did you deal with the adrenaline of those early years? Because that's what you must have lived on.
So, Vicky, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, to put it all in context, you know, 5 years, 8 months, you know, I've battled for so long to try and actually understand what is 5 years, 8 months, you know, and I found the best way to do it was to actually personify it, you know, to actually look at someone's child and say, well, you weren't around before I was kidnapped, and now you are back. So actually this is, and you are this tall, and this is exactly what 5 years, 8 months is. So I've battled, and, you know, so I was, this was, living there in the desert, it wasn't a flash in the pan. Something which just happened and disappeared. It was something which I would wake up to every morning for 5 years, 8 months. And it, I certainly went to some incredibly dark places, you know. I didn't talk to my family for 5 years, 8 months. Not once. I had no idea what was going on in the outside world. I heard rumors here and there which seemed to contradict each other, you know, with time. And I just realized at the end, you know, during this situation, I just realized that I had nobody on my team. I was absolutely alone. I was having these most insane experiences. I mean, terrible experiences and amazing experiences, which people, you know, seeing sunsets and seeing ponds in the Sahara, which I wish I would have loved to have shared with people. Amazing experiences. But I realized that because I was alone, I really had to dig deep, and I could only really rely on myself, you know. At the end of the day, life's a choice, and you can choose to be happy or you can choose to be miserable. You can choose to get through or you can choose to sink. And I think, fortunately, as humans, we tend towards equilibrium and we tend towards life. So I think half the work was done for me through genetics, and the rest was probably just trying to apply myself.
Yeah, because yes,
be positive.
You mentioned about your grandfather. I mean, there's another book, another movie, who manages to survive being a prisoner of war in Italy. Yeah. When he's waist deep in the snow and he was hunting dogs to survive. I mean, that is shows that it was in your DNA as well. But that's another book, isn't it?
That, you know, that was crazy because as a youngster, you know, when I was in my early teens, we used to go down to our farm in the Eastern Free State, myself and friends, and we'd sit around the fire, and my grandfather would, you know, would start forth with these stories about trying to find potatoes and eating people's dogs, you know, because he was just so hungry. And I sat, and it was funny, there in the desert, there were a couple of parallels between my grandfather and I. And I love my grandfather dearly. He was an incredible man. And he also enjoyed motorbikes, and I enjoyed my motorbikes, and he also was a prisoner of war. And I suppose I, being caught as a tourist, but I was held as a prisoner of war for my 5 years, 8 months. Yeah, I mean, those were also crazy times, I think, that my grandfather went through.
No, most definitely. And, of course, during your incarceration, to get back to the fact that your prison was a very interesting one. It was open air. It was basically the whole Sahara Desert, one of the biggest deserts in the world. But, I mean, you could have run away from Al-Qaeda for 20 paces and the heat and the sand would have just nailed you.
Yeah, I mean, imagine jumping in Cape Town, jumping in the sea and heading out 500 kilometers and then putting yourself behind a swell and making camp there, because that's exactly what it was like in the Sahara. Literally heading hundreds of kilometers into the middle of nowhere, and you don't know where the wells are, you don't know where the food is, you've got no transport. And to be quite honest, you know, escaping would have been a ridiculous idea, especially considering the heat of the summers. I even heard stories about Al-Qaeda members that got lost and they ended up dying a kilometer from a well because they just happened to think it was, you know, they were a kilometer off track. So the Sahara is grueling. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Do you think just at that level, the Sahara, in terms of being nature on this earth, that it teaches us a huge lesson about our fragility as a species?
You know, we were being chased. We were being chased by a surveillance airplane one night, and I was walking, and I came across this little tortoise that was just walking around, looking for food, just living. And I was in the middle of nowhere, and I sat there in absolute awe, looking at this tortoise, thinking, you know, this is sort of, if a tree falls over in a forest, do you hear it? Well, this little tortoise is walking around, and no one in the world knows about this tortoise, but yet it is surviving, and it is living. And it is us humans that are destroying this planet while this poor tortoise runs around over its sand dunes in the middle of nowhere. I honestly believe that us as humans need to get our act together, you know, to actually pull things together. Otherwise, everyone's in trouble.
Absolutely. We just tuned in. We're discussing 6 years with Al-Qaeda. The Stephen McGowan story is told to Tudor Caradoc-Davies. Stephen McGowan and Tudor Caradoc-Davies are online. We're going to cut away for 30 seconds of headlines. Then we're going to carry on our discussion for another 5 minutes, 6 years with Al-Qaeda.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Welcome back to the Stephen McGowan story, as told to Tudor Carrick, Doc Davies. Stephen and Tudor are online. 6 years with Al Qaeda, a Maverick 451 publication, and of course it is a recommended read. To get back to the book, Tudor, as somebody who had to write it, what is your biggest takeaway from your experience?
That would probably be how we, as Steve touched on a little bit earlier, we all have a different perspective on these things. You know, I expected to, Steve to be a lot angrier. Obviously, he's not. He doesn't have great fondness for Al Qaeda because of what they did. But he managed to connect with them on a individual and sort of organizational level, and to understand, you know, who some of these teenage kids were, and also in terms of the geopolitics of what's gone on in the Sahel over the years, just to understand what brings some of these kids into Al Qaeda. So it was really just fascinating to kind of understand how much he saw and lived, as he said, you know, that it's not a quick thing. He was there for years and years and years. So that was really powerful.
No, absolutely. And Stephen, of course, I mean, you've already spoken to us about the issue of time, and that is a big question, 5 years and 8 months, as you say. There was, of course, sadness because your mom passed on while you were away and you never really knew about it. But what was it like when you actually realized that you were actually released? Not being released, because I'm sure you were pretty guarded about that. Your feelings when you finally knew that you were going home?
That is, you know, I still don't know if I'm fully released. It's a peculiar thing. It happened. I'd obviously lived there for so long, and I'd had my guard up for so long. I really was not even sure, you know, I'd become something. I was not even sure when they said that I was released, that I actually was released. And I think just the nature of survival, of the nature of having to put your walls up, I often refer to it as, you know, the saying, no man is an island. Well, this man became an island. I became an island, and I wasn't particularly proud of it. It was something that was necessary for survival. I had to be able to count on myself to get through. And it's something that I've been really working on since my release, to actually be able to let people in, let people close, to listen to opinions, because it just makes life so much more wholesome, you know, to work as a team. But, I mean, the point is, it's certainly a process. It is a process. That's all I can say. You know, 5 years, 8 months at that stage was one-sixth of my life. I spent one-sixth of my life, you know, in captivity. And it's not something where you just flip a switch and say, well, now I'm free. I've certainly taken away so many, you know, positive things from my experience, you know, to live every day, make the most of it, live a balanced life, things like this, you know, be generous with people, help people where you can, because life is about people. But I cannot say that there ever was a absolute revolution, you know, that now I am free, because I think I'd been guarded for so long. But what I can say is, when I was released and I hopped on an aeroplane, there was an Afrikaans air hostess on the aeroplane, and she spoke with her Afrikaans accent, and that left me in tears. That parted this mist in my mind and reminded me of home, where I was loved, and that was probably the most profound experience that I actually had with my whole release process.
Yeah, it's amazing how, when you go through these experiences, that funny things trigger memories, isn't it? And I'm sure that as you're going along now, that something will happen and that will remind you of this and remind you of that. I mean, obviously, not necessarily in a negative sense, but it just reminds you.
100%. I mean, if you want me to literally go pale and you want me to almost crash my car, put on the word Britain in Afrikaans, say Britannia, and that word runs incredibly deep, because I was referred to as Britannia in the desert. Right, take Britannia over there, put Britannia over there. Let's look at a video about a beheading of Britannia. The word Britannia for me was basically almost a death word for me in the desert. And still now, 3 years out the desert, if I hear the word Britannia on a radio station, it catches me absolutely off guard, and I'm quite surprised it still runs so deep, I must be honest.
It's amazing, isn't it? And of course, you had to learn so much about human nature, as you've already said, because the two other guys that you were captured with, Johan and Jacques, that there it became very obvious to you from the very beginning that it was, in a sense, every man for himself. That must have been a hugely sobering time of your experience.
It was very difficult. I used to swim at school, which isn't a particularly team sport, but I played a bit of rugby and that was a team sport. And I've always seen myself as a bit of a team player. I've always enjoyed people, laughing, joking, getting along as a team. And I honestly expected us to have been a team there in the desert. It really caught me off guard. But what I can say is I probably grew far more as a person because we were not a team. It really required me to dig, to really call on reserves, which I didn't even know I had. So, but yes, I mean, in the book, there are so many strange stories that actually took place between the three of us. It was, we were three guys, three different countries, three different ages, and we had three different strategies. And that really is what separated us within our own sort of hut hostage, team, us team had been kidnapped, as well as what separated us within Al-Qaeda's eyes. And it was quite funny watching how people, how Al-Qaeda viewed us differently because of our attitudes and our behavior.
In fact, I mean, I think one of the big lessons that comes for me in reading the book is that your more positive outlook, being more approachable, as difficult as it might have been, seemed to have got you far more mileage than your two other colleagues who were in captivity, and one of them in particular didn't really have a very good attitude, and it counted against him, didn't it?
Most definitely. But, at the end of the day, the way I view it is, if you are something for a period of time, you're going to become that.
Yeah.
And that was one of the main things. I did not want to create bad habits while I was in the desert, and I did not want to come out of the desert and require years of rehabilitation, require my wife having to really get to know me, assuming I still had a wife, requiring my mates to put up with some angry person. I couldn't. My family were going through enough with me in the desert. They did not need to go through extra pain and anguish after my release, should I ever be released, because I had a bad, because I had a bad attitude, in the desert there, and allowed myself to fall into some bad places, mentally, I suppose, mostly mentally.
So many questions, so little time. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Stephen McGowan and Tudor Caradoc-Davies, 6 years with Al-Qaeda, the incredible story of the South African who became Al-Qaeda's longest-held prisoner, 5 years and 8 months, Maverick 451 from the Daily Maverick stable. I think I can say that quite safely. It is a recommended read. Get it at a bookshop near you before it flies off the shelf. Stephen McGowan, Tudor Caradoc-Davies, a pleasure talking to you guys. Well done, and may you go from strength to strength.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
Drive Time 91.3, always on the cutting edge.